to Procrastination Planet, where we should be writing, but
we're back, everybody. I'm Carly Knight.
I'm Janine Biggs.
Yay! I'm not flying solo this week.
Thanks for having me.
So today, this is a very spoiler-heavy episode. We're going to be talking about the book Girl Waits with Gun by Amy Stewart. We're going to talk about all the things we liked about the book, things that kind of raised a few questions, just kind of doing a deep dive into a book. Yeah, I sounded really super articulate. Okay, so if you haven't read the book or if you're really sensitive about spoilers,
don't listen.
Yeah, maybe skip this episode until you finish reading the book. Also, read the fucking book. You should have read the fucking book by now.
Read the book.
You're welcome.
It was from this podcast where I read the book.
I made her read the book.
You did. You talked about it on one of your episodes and I went and got it. Actually, I borrowed it from the library. But hey, that's what the library is for.
That's right. And also, if you have enough people demanding to check out a particular book, libraries will buy more copies of that book.
Right.
So if you have to get a book from the library, you're actually helping author sales.
Yay.
Yay.
That'll be us soon.
Damn right. Okay, I hate mouth noise. I'm trying to maintain like the right level of hydration because I feel like not enough hydration and I feel like I have that sticky mouth kind of noise that I hate. But then too much hydration, I feel like, oh my God, can people hear my saliva sloshing around in my mouth? It's like I'm trying to have the exact amount of hydration to dehydration ratio. As I've listened to and edited various podcasts, it just made me conscious about how noisy the mouth actually is and how much I fucking hate mouth noise. Oh my God. Even my own. I listen to myself and I'm like, wait, what the fuck is wrong with me? Okay, so people complain about Virgos being super critical and all that kind of thing. And it's true. It's hard to be right all the time and everyone else is wrong. But we are like triple, quadruple as hard on ourselves. So if you think we're being rough on you and we're acting like we're fucking perfect, I mean, we are, but we're still really super self-critical. We're actually more critical of ourselves than we are of everyone we're critical of. But anyway, what was your sign, Janine?
I'm a Capricorn.
Okay, I think that's why we get along, Earth sign energy.
Well, I don't know, my husband's a Virgo. And sometimes we get along and sometimes we don't.
Yeah, the Virgo-Capricorn pairing is actually supposed to be a really good pairing.
Yeah, no, it's. I was just joking. It's good pairing.
I'm married to a triple Scorpio.
A triple Scorpio?
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, he's total true Scorpio. So
oh,
it's like
I got it.
So it's like an intense household. Because Virgo energy is super intense. Yep. Scorpio energy is super intense.
I saw a meme yesterday, day before, and it reminded me of you.
Oh, no.
And this might cause sparks in the studio today.
Oh, no.
But it was funny. It said something about, stop blaming your horoscope for being a horrible person. your zodiac sign for being a horrible person. I was like, oh, Carly would hate this.
I'm just a horrible person naturally.
Yeah, it was funny. I was like, oh, he did not go there. Yes, he did. It was funny.
Well, you got to have a sense of humor about your shit.
You do. Mm-mm. You do. I'm just straight up a bitch.
I'm not critical and bitchy because I'm a Virgo. I'm critical and bitchy because everyone else is like fucking up.
True. Yeah.
And by the way, I'm not doing this astrology thing because I'm jumping on the trendy bandwagon. I've always been into astrology, so yeah.
As long as I've known you, which has been about 4 years now, and a half.
Something like that, yeah.
You've always talked about astrology.
Being a Virgo.
Yep.
Okay, let's do a little housekeeping real quick. If you like Procrastination Planet, don't forget to like, subscribe, download, leave a 5-star rating, and a quick review in order to push us up the charts and get us all famous and shit. You can hit us up on social media, Twitter at ProcrastPlanet, Instagram at Procrastination Planet Podcast, plain old Procrastination Planet on Facebook. Also, you can email us, procrastinationplanetpod@gmail.com. Let us know how we're doing. Say hello. Tell us we're pretty. If you decide to leave hate mail or a shit post or whatever, we'll read it on the air.
And it's still a review.
Oh, yeah. All publicity is good publicity. You can also go to procrastinationplanet.com and go to the merch page. That will take you to Teespring, and that will get you to all of our nifty logo merch, stickers included.
I like stickers.
I need more stickers in my life. Okay, so that's housekeeping. So let's get to Girl Waits with Gun.
Okay.
It's a historical mystery based on real-life characters. The real-life cop sisters, K-O-P-P. The real-life Constance Cop turned out to be the first lady deputy in her county in New Jersey. And the book takes place in 1914. And let's see. The inspiration for this book came when Amy Stewart was researching another Henry Kaufman. And she kind of stumbled upon this other Henry Kaufman, whose fuckery was far more compelling. And then she kind of stumbled into Constance Cop that way. I need to make sure to link to her site and everything in the show notes. But anyway, the real life cop sisters had a run in with Henry Kaufman. Let's see, his car, he and his little gangster friends were joyriding. His car collided with the cop sisters while they were on a horse cart.
Their buggy.
Yes, their buggy. And he wouldn't pay for the damages. So she,
pursued it.
And he and his gangster buddies decided to threaten her instead, because why pay for the damages even though you're wealthy? That's how rich people stay rich, is because they're cheap.
Yeah. And his whole attitude was he didn't have to do it. And why should he? And it goes on from there.
So then we have our adventure. So basically this book is kind of spent, they're trying to keep Henry Cop and all of his gangster friends from threatening their life.
Kaufman.
Ugh. So Constance and her sisters are trying to keep from, they're trying to keep protected from Henry Kaufman and his gangster buddies, because they will not quit.
Right.
Then there's like the subplot where one of the workers in his factory, well, she had a love child by Kaufman, and he kidnapped the child, and they have to find the child. And so Constance is compelled to
find the child.
Yeah, exactly.
She gets caught up in it, and she's on a personal journey, and more about why that is revealed.
Exactly.
And we said it earlier, there's going to be spoilers, so just suck it. I've been watching a lot of Psych because I found it on Amazon Prime, and yay! I just binged the shit out of it. So you're going to hear suck it a lot out of me.
Suck it!
Suck it!
I'm Carly Knight, and this is my partner, Janine TT Showbiz.
I just saw that episode, too.
Oh, my God. American Duos is American like the best Duos episode.
Because I've already binged the entire series. I'm doing it again because I can, and it's awesome. I love Psych.
It's one of my favorite shows of all time.
I've heard it both ways.
No, you haven't, Sean.
We should just do a show on Psych.
I know. We've made so many Psych references on this show.
There's another movie coming out, too. I think it's called Lassie Come Home.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know when it's coming. I think it's post-production, so maybe this year or next year. But I'm all excited. I'm there.
I'm so excited. I'm so scared. Okay, in our fictional detectives episode, Jill had brought up the whole idea that your fictional detective is part of a triad.
Right. I remember that.
So Sherlock Holmes has Watson, and then also there's Mycroft or Lestrade. I never get the inspector's name right.
I don't either.
But those two are kind of interchangeable. But they kind of offer some different perspectives and kind of balance out the main character. And I've seen the triad come to play in Girl Waits with Gun.
I'm with you there. I totally see it.
Okay, so we have Constance. She's our main character. She's a very formidable woman. She is really tall. She was described by somebody in here as burly. She's a very substantial woman.
That's a really good word. That's a very good word. In fact, when I started reading this, I Googled Amy Stewart, and she had links up about the cop sisters, and she was a pretty substantial woman. Very sturdy and tall. She was a big lady, but...
And hella strong.
Very strong, at least according to the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's like one of the problems that I think in my... What worked and what didn't work. What she did with her size was a little problematic for me, so we can get into that a little later.
Okay.
When we get there.
Sounds good. So we have Constance right in the middle. As far as her two sisters go, they're part of the triad. I consider them more of the triad than the sheriff.
Oh, no, see, I disagree.
Okay. Well, we've got Norma. She's really super sensible. She's very tomboyish, but in some ways, like, super conservative and traditional. but also she doesn't subscribe to the traditional norms of femininity.
True.
She cuts her hair. She wears split skirts. She wears pants if she could.
She has homing pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
And she would rather just stay on the farm. And I kind of perceived her as asexual.
Yeah.
Which is, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just she, hermit-like almost.
I kind of feel like she'd be a lesbian if she had the vocabulary for it. I don't know why. I think maybe I'm getting stereotypical with like the short hair and the pants and like the fact that she would rather do like activities that aren't traditionally feminine. But my gaydar was blipping on her.
Seriously, I thought she was asexual. Okay. I mean, I didn't see an interest in either sex. And it was both she and Constance are in their early 30s. And
yeah.
She had no, you know, the whole biological clock wasn't in her perception. And again, no romantic feelings came out of her about anything. I don't remember her commenting on anybody's appearance, man or woman.
Okay.
So that's why I kind of got the asexual type of vibe.
You know, I think you might have a fair point. And asexuality isn't something that's given a lot of media or pop culture attention unless it's shown off as some kind of like abnormality.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So, hey, the idea that we have an asexual character representing.
Right.
I'm for it.
And to me, that kind of raised a question about her sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was weird because that's, you know, a woman in her 30s, you're going to have some type of interest or feelings pop up. And she didn't, her character in this book didn't show that.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. She's not showing interest one way or another. Although I've noticed, like with Morrissey, Michael Stipe, Clay Aiken, before they came out as gay, they identified as asexual. Like in some sort of attempt to hide their sexuality.
Didn't we all know that Clay Aiken was gay from the minute he stepped on stage?
We knew it before he did.
Right, okay. It was sort of a given. I don't know.
Okay, so we have on the other end of the sister spectrum, Fleurette. I think she's 16 years old in end of the story of the time.
She turns 16, right? She's 15 at the beginning and then she turns 16.
She turns 16, okay. Yeah. I was a little confused about her age when they talk about it.
I was too at the beginning and...
She's only 14. No, 15. No, 16. Wait.
I think she's 15.
Yeah, I think maybe Constance was aging her down to kind of play up the fact that the gangsters were trying to be really super inappropriate.
Right. But because they go to the beach, remember? She wants to go to the beach for her birthday and I believe it's her 16th birthday.
Okay, so Fleurette is very frivolous.
And her whimsical.
Her name completely matches who she is. She's this little flower and very, like, whimsical, I think, is a good term. She pretty much just does her own thing. She's unconventional in her own right. She's very hyper-feminine.
She is very hyper-feminine.
Yeah, she's hyper-feminine. And then you have Nora, who's, she would read as not feminine at all, according to social norms. And then Fleurette kind of subscribes to notions of traditional femininity. I mean, not traditional in a sense that she's willing to do like traditional stuff.
Right.
She's socially unconventional. She totally has a mind of her own.
And they keep her at home, too.
Yeah.
She dances around and she sings and she's a very good seamstress, but she's all into the girly stuff.
And then Constance is right there in the middle.
Right.
So we covered the triad. Hi there, Jill. Shout out.
I still think the sheriff is part of the triad, though.
Okay.
But that's just me. I was thinking the sheriff and Nora and Constance, but...
I feel like Fleurette propels her to do the investigation a little more. I'm thinking, like, Norma and the sheriff are more interchangeable. Like, he's kind of the sidekick that will provide the ammunition and teach them how to shoot.
Right.
And Fleurette is the one who actually compels her to continue the investigation.
You know what? You're right. Now that I think about it, because Norma, and I called her Nora a minute ago, Norma, she just wants Florence to drop Constance to drop everything and just let it go. And she would just rather them live out their lives on the farm, which she found, Norma found. And Fleurette wants Constance to just keep digging.
Because what if the baby got sent off to Russia to become a czar or something like that? She always has all these weird, fanciful tales that she likes to tell.
She does. And I love the fact how they said that she just makes up stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. And she just does it at the drop of a hat. Nobody bats an eye.
Right. And half the time, they don't know if she's telling the truth or if it's a tall tale.
Mm-hmm. Constance kind of wonders, how often has she had us fooled?
So, yeah, I guess. Okay. I see that triad. I do. I did like the sheriff's character.
Oh, yeah.
Parts of it. Some of it was definitely, it pinpointed the time. Because okay. It's the early 1900s, and for a minute there, I didn't think he was married, and then you find out he is married, and... Yeah.
And of course, his wife's a nagging shrew.
I didn't like that.
Yeah.
I didn't like that portrayal, and also, I didn't like when he said his wife knows her place. I didn't mm-hmm. really like that either, but then I had to think, it's 1914, and that's the mindset back then, so... I wouldn't do well back in the early 1900s. I'd probably be dead somewhere because I pissed somebody off.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I would be too. I mean, I say this shit, but also I can be all timid and mousy and such a people pleaser too. I would probably be a poisoner. Yeah, I think that nagging shrew wife trope in there was just a little bit extra. I think they're trying to play up the sexual tension between the sheriff and Constance. And it kind of felt like a dishonest way of going about it, because it wouldn't... I mean, the sheriff is obligated to his wife, but if she were, like, portrayed more sympathetically...
Right.
I guess maybe they... I guess maybe she didn't want the audience to hate Constance for being the other woman or something like
that. But she really wasn't the other woman.
Yeah, but people tend to blame the object of a married man's affections for his straying rather than himself.
And I am a romantic. I really am. So I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Because I was also thinking, too, maybe it's a way to make the sheriff a little more sympathetic for kind of having that tension with her. I don't know. I'm actually wondering, now that I'm sitting here, this isn't one of my points of contention with the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually wondering if there needed to be a sexual tension subplot in there anyway.
The sexual tension between Constance and the sheriff?
Because there seemed to be like some sexual tension going on.
Okay. And I thought that too. And I thought I was the only one who thought that because I'm a romantic and I always want there to be romance and mm-hmm. sexual tension. So I thought it was just me being me, but I like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if it would have played better because, I mean, she's in her early 30s and he's an attractive man in a position of power. I wonder if it would have worked better that she could feel like there's some sort of attraction there, but then know it's off limits and the tension is just kind of on her side that she just has to deny that part of herself.
I kind of got that, though, because he's married and I got that. And I actually liked how he came about because he wasn't the one she was dealing with at first. Wasn't it the chief of police?
Yeah.
Who just pretty much brushed her off and was in Henry Kaufman's pocket, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think we could have done without him being attracted to her because of his nagging shrew wife or whatever.
Oh,
Yeah, I was...
That's a trope.
Tropes aren't bad. Tropes are tools. It just depends on how you use a trope... And which tropes are overdone and problematic.
And if it works. And this one, I didn't like the shrew wife.
Yeah. I mean, I got from Constance that she was kind of feeling a little bit of guilt for that attraction. I think I just wish that were more of a one-sided thing, that he didn't return that attraction, that he had a, like, quote-unquote good wife at home. I mean, I understand the wife's kind of skepticism of having... strange people and coming and going in their house and all that sort of thing. I just wish she would have been like portrayed as less of that nagging shrew type.
More supportive, a supportive wife, rather than the, like you said, nagging shrew.
Yeah.
At home with the kids. And
or like she kind of realizes that Constance isn't really a threat.
Right.
Because we have like way too much of this like pitting women against women kind of thing. And I would have liked to see maybe a little bit less of that.
Well, I was thinking also that this might have been the first time the wife had to deal with this, too.
Yeah.
Because her husband probably deals a lot more with men than women. So that could have been it.
Yeah. But the wife, she doesn't seem to change or...
True.
Or shift. There's no real character arc as far as her, like, becoming accepting of the situation.
Right.
Realizing that She doesn't really have to worry about Constance.
But he doesn't help it either, because at Thanksgiving, Constance is worried about him being away from his family. Mm-hmm. And she even makes a comment, well, you know, what's your wife going to think? And that's when he makes a comment, she knows her place.
Yeah.
That kind of irritated me. But
yeah, I don't like that.
I don't either.
Like, maybe it would have worked better if he said, yeah, I'm worried, but she understands this is part of the job.
Right.
Like, every cop, like, their spouse is worried if they're going to come home. That's like in the opening of Homicide Hunter with Joe Kenda.
Oh, right.
Oh, my God. I love that show so much.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about her writing style?
Sure.
Or do you want to talk about the plot?
Let's talk about her writing style.
Okay. So, I actually liked her writing style. I didn't have a lot of issues with it.
Yeah, it felt very period appropriate.
It did. And Tim Lewis gets in my head. Every time I saw an adverb, I cringe. Yeah. And
then I let adverbs go, quite honestly. If it's historical or romance, I'm just like, that's part of the genre. So they're kind of invisible to me unless there's this huge trend of using adverbs to prop up really weak verbs.
Right. And so when I see one, I automatically think, am I missing something? Should there be a show don't tell here? Should she have expanded a little bit more? And that's the only thing. And darn you, Tim Lewis. I don't look at adverbs the same way anymore. And I am one that I love adverbs, but it makes your story so much stronger when you show don't tell. Uh-huh. But her style was fine. I didn't have an issue with it. And I thought I liked it.
Yeah, I found the characters like really vivid.
Right. She has good character development.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, my God. Fleurette. Hilarious.
Yeah.
She very much is a teenager. And I think even before the concept of the teenage years has been invented, it's actually a very recent concept. This whole teenage thing is a whole separate stage. But I kind of feel like with the hormones and all that sort of thing going on, you're still going to be kind of dramatical and still trying to figure out this new adult body that suddenly happened.
Right.
So Fleurette, I love her priorities. Like when in the opening scene, when they have that collision, everyone's concerned about her ankle.
And she was driving.
Yeah. And here's a little passage. Okay, so Constance is checking her and telling her to kind of move her ankle, see if she's okay, see if she's injured. We both looked down at her feet. She was wearing the most ridiculous white calfskin boots with pink ribbons for laces. Are they all right? She asked. I put my hand on her back to steady her. Just try to move them. First your ankle. I meant the boots.
Yep, that's Fleurette.
Priorities, Fleurette. That's when I knew Fleurette would survive.
Since I started writing, I prefer third person rather than first, but first person in this works. There were only a couple parts that I thought it would be better third person.
Okay.
But for the most part, the first person worked.
Yeah, usually with historical literature, first person feels anachronistic.
Okay.
I mean, novels have been written in first person, like back right. in the day. It's not really a new concept, but I'm trying to unpack what it is about first person that can feel anachronistic. I think sometimes third person, usually if it's like a slightly more omniscient or distant narrator, tends to feel a little more old-timey.
Right.
I've kind of noticed that, like when I'm trying to write for Beatrice, that's my 1917 book. When I was trying to write it in first person, it just kept feeling too, like, contemporary YA.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't get into the voice very well. But then when I switched to third person, it felt a little more historically appropriate.
And Amy Stewart does a really good job getting the historical attributes.
Yeah.
In first person. And
that's a skill.
It is. And like I said, over the years of reading, and especially after I started writing, I do prefer third person. But I'll read first person. I'll read it.
It just has to work because it's really hard not to be conscious or write with I.
Correct. She does a good job. So yeah, her writing style was pretty much on point. And she has one or two more books in the Cop series, or?
I think she's got more now.
And I'm looking forward to reading those because the ending of this book is a total setup. Just a total setup.
Definitely. And since this is a spoiler heavy episode, the second book's title is already a spoiler. Lady Cop Causes Trouble.
Yeah.
When Lady Cop Makes Trouble.
Yeah.
Which is it? Which is it? Let me turn to, because in my copy, my trade paperback copy, you get a sneak preview of the next book.
Oh, nice. I don't have that in the library copy. And I hope it's in your copy, but at the end of
Lady Cop Makes Trouble.
Oh, there you go. At the end of the first book, well, the library one, there's the acknowledgments, and it really goes into
the historical notes.
Yeah, that's it. The historical notes. And that's worth reading. In fact, I wish I had like grabbed a passage out of that to read. Maybe I can look and see real quick.
I saw a review of this book, and someone had dinged the subplot with the missing baby to be padding, and I thought that was silly.
I think it sets it up for her becoming the first deputy, don't you?
Yeah, and I think...
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, number one, you gotta have a subplot, otherwise you just have a novella.
True.
And the subplot tends to inform the main plot as well, and those two plots intersect anyway. And two, I think it kind of raises... let's see... It's like a mutual symbiosis where her backstory informs that subplot, and the subplot kind of adds depth to her character as far as her backstory goes.
Right.
Because her backstory, it kind of helps, along with Florette, kind of helps to propel her to pursue this case.
And from the historical and source notes, I'm not sure if that was actually the case. Do you know if...
I think that was...
The Florette line was the case.
Okay, so let's see. Let's just go ahead and get into her backstory.
Okay.
Because we're... It's a spoiler site.
It's a spoiler, yeah.
It's a spoiler episode. I was saying spoiler site.
She does little flashbacks, which I like.
Mm-hmm. About them growing up in Brooklyn before their move to Paterson, New Jersey.
Right.
Or the outskirts of Paterson, New Jersey.
Correct.
So let's see. Basically, Constance... Was she like 17 or something when this happened?
I believe so.
She was home alone and... Let's see, Norma was out at her dance recitals or something.
She was somewhere.
Yeah, I believe that it was dancing lessons. I'd refused to take Norma, to dancing lessons any longer. Mother wouldn't let her go alone, so every Wednesday and Saturday, you know, so they would be out of the house. The dad was gone.
Yeah, he took off.
Yeah, there's no dad in the picture. So she's home alone. And the singer man, the sewing machine repair and salesman... comes a knocking because he's got wares.
And she lets him in with her mother screaming in her head that she shouldn't let strangers in the house, but she does.
And they end up having an affair.
Right.
And Constance ends up being a girl in trouble.
And he knows what to do with girls in trouble.
So she ends up in a home for unwed girls.
Right.
And I think that was, I think Florence was the name of the house, the lady who ran the home.
Oh, right. Florette. Oh, and we forgot a very important part. There's a brother.
Yes. Their brother, Francis.
Francis. And he's, at this time, he's still at home.
Okay, so she's sent off to this home for unwed mothers. They end up having the baby who, spoiler alert, turns out to be Florette.
Florette, yes.
But
she leaves without her mom or Norma or Francis knowing.
Yeah.
The singer guy sets her up in this home because he knows what to do. Yes, he knows what to do.
He's maybe done this before.
Or he knows people who've done it before.
Something.
Yeah, it's hinted very much.
Yeah. And she can't really get rid of Florette. She doesn't want to leave the baby. You know, they bond. I mean, she can't really be in denial. She wanted to try and do the denial thing, but it didn't work.
Right.
And she kind of gets attached to the baby.
Norma and Francis find her.
Yeah. And they can't exactly move back to Brooklyn with the new baby.
Correct.
It's going to look bad for everybody.
So that's when Norma finds the farm on the outskirts of town in Paterson.
Yeah. So they move out where they don't really know anybody. Well, that way the mom can conceivably raise Florette as her little change of life baby.
Correct.
And they could just play up the fact that, oh, she's a poor widow who is left with a new baby. And
I think there was a mention, if I'm remembering correctly, that if anybody asked about, you know, who the father was, they could say the dad had come home for just a brief period and Florette was the result.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting that, you know, she had to go into the pantry closet or the pantry and nurse her and then give her to her mom. She couldn't show any motherly instincts at all toward her. So yeah. Florette would know the mom as her mother.
Yeah, they had to raise them out openly as sisters.
Correct.
And she had to kind of carry that pretense for the sake of like believability, even so that she and Florette could kind of believe that themselves.
And do you wonder that is it ever going to be revealed to Florette that Constance is her mom?
I'm not sure.
I think that...
Well, she'll end up being a serial killer like Ted Bundy if that happens. Because Ted Bundy was raised to believe his mom was his sister and...
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not know that.
But then again,
I should have, but I didn't.
But then, wait a minute. Jack Nicholson was also raised to believe his mom was his sister and that kind of situation as well. So
maybe,
maybe she'll be a movie star if this is
maybe
all revealed. So maybe that's a setup that she becomes a big movie star. And
well, see, this is in the back of my mind now. I'm thinking, is Florette ever going to find out that Constance is her mother?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure in real life she didn't.
And Norma is her aunt.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure in real life she didn't get that, but... It kind of explains why Florette was so, like, indulged and spoiled.
She was very indulged. And Constance even says that. She and Norma both say that. And at the beginning, when I even started doing the math in my head as much as I can math in my head, which isn't very well. And I was thinking, wow, there's quite an age difference between mm-hmm. Florette and the rest of them. And then when she starts revealing, and I liked the way Amy Sturr did the reveal.
Yeah.
It wasn't all at once. It was just over these little flashbacks.
And the way she kind of juxtaposed those snippets of flashback between like the real time of the story.
Right.
It served to raise the stakes. And it served to kind of add depth to the character.
Because when she first meets Lucy Blake and finds out, you know, Lucy had an affair with the boss and she got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that when the flashbacks start?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that subplot worked in very well because it gives depth to the Constance character.
And it also gives Florette. Depth. Yeah, definitely. And it makes even more sense that Florette is the one to kind of propel her to pursue this investigation.
Correct.
Even though Florette doesn't know that she was a foundling baby, Constance knows this. And so she's able to kind of cave to her request a little more.
And I like how Norma, she's very subtle about it, but she throws it in her face about Constance, you mm-hmm. know, getting in trouble.
And that's why she's always so protective of Florette.
Yeah.
And then the reveal later on.
Right.
That she's really Florette's mother adds like another layer to why she attacked Kaufman.
Correct.
Because we have the scene where she goes to the factory the first time.
Mm-hmm. And she kind of manhandles them and throws them into the wall.
Yeah. So Kaufman is, of course, refusing to pay for damages. And then he says, well, he threatens to come over to the house.
Right.
And then he says, when I get there, tell me, through which window may I find Miss Florette's bedroom?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He's a piece of work.
Mm-hmm. And that's when Constance, who's like really super substantial and like bigger than this guy,
mm-hmm.
she like picks him up and bangs him against the wall.
Well, they portrayed him as not being real big anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And see, now this was the part of the plot that was a little problematic for me
mm-hmm.
because she can clearly overtake this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So why not just do it?
Oh, that whole just shoot him kind of thing.
Yeah. Why not just beat the crap out of him because she can? Because she embarrassed.
He's under sheriff protection too.
True.
He's got connections, and there's that one corrupt, was it the police chief or something?
Chief of police, yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't really doing anything, and
right.
So it was the sheriff who had to kind of...
Exactly.
But then he's got, I think there would be a lot of explaining and paperwork for the sheriff to have to do in order not to press charges against her for...
Oh, yeah.
All that kind of thing.
That's true. But she kind of, well, I guess she didn't really... cower, because if she did, they would have left town.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that. They stayed and fought pretty much.
And she still is like a product of her time.
Correct.
And like using I had a point And I lost it. But as soon as I found out that she was Florette's mother and not her sister,
right,
I'm like, that's why she got that violent.
I did the same
thing. If they were merely sisters, maybe there was a chance that she would have just threatened him.
Right.
And towered over him. But it's like, no, this is my daughter that you're fucking with.
Oh, yeah. Mama Bear comes out.
Mm-mm.
Boom.
A thin trickle of blood smeared the wall. Yeah, yes. She cracked his head.
She did.
Mm-mm.
I mean, she threw him in the wall.
Yeah.
And that's why... That's
I'm getting
why
all the feels talking about that. Holy fuck. Okay. But... sorry.
No, you go. You go, girl.
Go, Constance.
No, go, Carly. No, that's another reason why I'm just... In the back of my mind, I can't wait to see if it's revealed to Florette that Constance is her mother. And if it turns out in real life she never knew that, I'm going to have a little sad.
Yeah.
I would hope that they would have revealed that to her.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that that's actually based on true facts?
The circumstances of her birth?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that Constance is her mother.
Well, the circumstances of her birth are not entirely known.
Right.
But the basic facts, the identity of mother and father, the relevant dates, and the fact that Florette grew up not knowing the truth, have been verified through court documents and interviews with Florette's son.
And that's in the back, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the notes.
So maybe it was revealed if Florette's son knew.
Mm, maybe.
I'm hoping it is. So I have to keep reading her books so I can find out, but...
There we go.
So, yeah, that was my only little issue with the plot.
Yeah, I have to go through again to figure out why she didn't just use the force, as it were.
Right, right. Yeah.
But I think there's, like, some sort of, like, gender constructs playing in. Also, the fact that there'd be a lot of explaining to do. Does the sheriff have enough power to kind of protect her?
Right.
If she were to have done worse?
Right. Actually, I take that back. That wasn't the only issue I had with the plot.
Okay.
From the beginning, she has a really good opening chapter.
Yeah.
And it sets up the whole, you know, the whole plot, the whole story. And I think the first line is something like, it happened this summer of my 35th year or something like that. You know, remember when they collided with Henry K. Hoffman or Kaufman? Henry Kaufman. And, so it sets up the plot. And then I thought some of it, like toward the middle, I thought it kind of fell. I thought the plot sort of stagnated a little bit.
Okay.
And I thought it fell. And
like maybe got a little repetitive with the weight, the attack, the weight again.
No, because I had in my mind this was a mystery.
Okay.
You know, like a mystery, but not a mystery. So we know who it is, but I'm just like, is he going to get caught? So I... More suspense, I guess.
Okay, like a thriller almost.
Kind of, maybe. Suspense or a thriller.
Yeah, thrillers, you know who done it. You're just trying to catch up to the who.
Right, so I think maybe that's what I thought it was. But then, you know, Amy Stewart kind of goes, she's doing more background into Constance, and we're getting her motivation and her, and so to me that didn't work completely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it was a horrible book. I really liked the book, but it fell a little bit for me.
Okay.
Maybe she spent a little bit too much time on Constance rather than integrating it with the rest of the story.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, because every time you get into backstory, you're stopping the forward motion of the front story, as it were.
Yeah.
So maybe...
She kind of integrated it, I think, a little better.
Okay.
But if that's my only, you know, issue with it, it's like, it's really nothing.
Yeah. I pretty much had almost no issues, although when I was going through it again, I was wondering a little bit if her bumping into this photographer in his studio was a little coincidental.
What do you mean?
Like, she goes to the photographer, Henry Lamont.
Right.
In New York when she's doing her sleuthing.
Right.
In order to find the baby and all that kind of thing. The photographer happened to have some of these photographs.
Oh, yeah.
So
it was a bit convenient.
Yeah. I wondered if that was a little too much of a reliance on coincidence.
If that happened, though.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's a real life thing that happened. I didn't see any notes for that.
Right. I didn't either.
So,
but I did like that. I like
that it happened. I was wondering if there's like another way of making that happen, but it didn't bother me the first time reading it. So
then,
maybe it's not as big an issue. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. No, I was going to ask you what you thought, because Norma actually throws that up in her face about, you know, sleuthing and doing the pictures. And Constance actually kind of liked it.
Yeah. And I like that Norma is the one who lights the fire under her to get a damn job already.
Yeah.
Because
they're going to have to live with Francis eventually if they don't do something.
Yeah.
And then none of them want to do that.
Okay. So it's kind of an unexpected thing that makes sense.
Right.
Because Norma is the one who doesn't want her getting involved and that sort of thing. But at the same time, she's really pragmatic. She's pragmatic to a fault. She's like more Virgo than me, I'm sure.
She's very pragmatic. That's a good word.
And so her thing is, hey, you like doing this. You got paid for it. Why not do more of that so we don't have to live on the farm?
Right.
Or live with Francis, I should
say. Live with Francis. If she had her druthers, they'd stay on the farm.
Mm-hmm. But she loves that farm.
She does. And her pigeons. But I thought...
So her being the one to light that fire makes a lot of sense.
It does. The character development was really... It was good. It was very good. I just felt like they came to life. Like each sister had their own personality and their own, I don't know. They were just so different and alike.
Mm-hmm.
And they're good characters.
Oh, I found a good line about Norma. I think it also makes sense in light of that whole, you like taking pictures and snooping.
Uh-huh.
So this line here. Norma had an endless curiosity about other people's misfortunes. It was why she read so many newspapers. Something terrible was always happening to someone, somewhere. And Norma made it her business to know about it.
Yeah, that was Norma.
Yeah, so she likes vicarious kind of snooping.
Yeah.
I mean, she's worried about Constance, like, getting in trouble and danger and endangering Fleurette. But at the same time, if she could do, like, snooping without getting hurt,
right,
that would be a pragmatic career choice.
And she just hated the fact that Constance kept after Henry Kaufman.
Yeah.
I don't know how much $50 was in 1914, but...
Quite a bit.
It seems like it was quite a bit. And he owned a dye factory. Mm-hmm. He had the money and he just wouldn't pay because he didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all they wanted was a new buggy. That's all they wanted.
Yeah.
So I do like how she built up the suspense because some part of this was suspense. And with them coming to the house, I mean, I was reading this at night a couple times and it freaked me out. I don't read scary stuff at night. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't like scary movies, especially I don't.
Not late at night.
No. After Tim and I watched The Sixth Sense, we started it like really late. I had to stay up for like another hour and a half because I could not go to sleep. It scared the hell out of me. So some of this I was reading at night and it freaked me out. I was like, oh man.
Yeah. Like the bricks. Wasn't there like some kind of Molotov cocktail in there?
I think that was, isn't that when they went to the beach?
Yeah.
They came back and the house was on fire?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they were in the barn and I don't know.
I do remember Norma doing the repairs.
Yes.
Oh, and Fleurette trying to like design a costume for Constance when she has to meet the...
Right.
The go-between.
Right. Yes.
She like designs this really like bright, superfluous sort of cape.
That was fun.
Mm-hmm. Then she's like, I would do a much better job of standing in a conspicuous location.
Yeah.
And then Norma's just like, no, you're going to have to wear something practical. Just like the sheriff said.
Right. Now, I liked that part, how she portrayed Constance when the sheriff asks her or tells her to walk down the street. Was it 10 o'clock or 8 o'clock? I know it was in the evening.
Yeah. And a woman should not be unaccompanied at either hour, Janine. Come on.
I know. And Constance actually brings that to the attention of the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't come right out and say it, but she asks, am I walking down there by myself? I didn't like the fact that that was an issue, but I like the fact that she's still aware of society and what's right, what's not right, but
what the norms are.
Exactly.
What the norms are
for the time.
Yeah. That's kind of the tricky thing with historical fiction, too.
Right. Because I think our current day feelings want to get in there and we can't do that.
Yeah. But at the same time, too, let's see, like the concepts of fairness and justice aren't really new. Like people even white people agitated for abolitionism,
right,
women's rights, that sort of thing. I was watching, no, I wasn't watching it. It was a podcast. I can't watch a podcast. But you must remember this. She did like a short season on Song of the South.
Oh.
And she was talking about how, like a lot of people lean on the excuse of, oh, it was the 40s. That was how they thought. But even certain white audiences were talking about how retrogressive some of these values in the movie were.
Right.
So not being racist, not being sexist, it's not anachronistic to have your characters like bristle against that sort of thing.
Right.
But at the same time, outwardly, they might still conform to those sort of things, if that makes sense.
No, it does.
And a lot of people who did speak out against those things were often silenced. So like having a main character, I mean, a lot of people complain about, oh, this main character in this historical novel is conveniently modern.
Right.
But it's like, number one, like your main character might feel an obligation to get married and be a homemaker because that's what was done.
Yep.
But inside, she still has her own emotions. She still has her own thoughts. She still might feel constricted and like want something more.
Right. In fact, in one of our favorite TV shows, Mrs. Fisher's Murder Mysteries,
mm-hmm.
Franny has no use for society's norms.
Exactly.
Whereas Dot, who I love the series more than the books. The books were just horrible. I think I read the first one. I'm not sure if I got completely through it or if I tried to read the second one. I can't remember. It was so much different than the series.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the series. Anyway.
I love the series too. My God.
The series is great. But Dot, you know, mm-hmm. she's going to get married and he thinks she's just going to quit her job and she mm-hmm. doesn't want to quit.
Yeah.
And she almost breaks up with him because of it. But it was around the same time. It was mm-hmm. It was right after World War One. So it's what, the 1920s, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
And where Franny, she's just like, yeah, I don't really give a shit about what you think I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do what I want. I love her character.
Yeah. And women were pressured to cave and like, give up their careers for that marriage. And then on the inside, though, they're like, oh, God, what did I do?
Right.
But outwardly, they have to pretend everything is okay because that's the time.
I was really hoping that series came back because I don't think Dot, I think Dot would have continued to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, she would have definitely continued to work. And then you got to see Franny get with the detective, man. Yeah. Hello.
And the thing, too, like when people complain about the historical main character being conveniently too modern. The thing about your main character is you want them to be, you know, a little more interesting than your average, everyday, boring schmo.
Exactly. And in the book, she had her going to church. And in the TV series, she doesn't want anything to do with mm-hmm. any religion. And yeah. I just thought that was weird. And Dot was more...
I think Dot was like an ex-pickpocket or something.
Something like that. I was going to say she was less cultured. I mean,
yeah.
She was more on the streets. And in the series, she's not. She came from a low-income home, but still an intact home.
Yeah. Okay, so Constance.
We digress.
Yeah, we do digress. That's what we do. So Constance, she's aware of the social norms, and she... I mean, she doesn't act like a 21st century heroine, but at the same time, you know that she's got a mind of her own and she's not just some mindless conforming type drone.
Right. Which is why she goes after Henry Kaufman.
Yeah. And she likes having a job.
She does.
She likes working.
Which I don't think she did until this came about.
Yeah. She had to find something she wanted to do. I think
right.
Actually, you know what? I think she had wanted some other jobs, but her mom had thrown away the correspondence paperwork or whatever.
Right.
So she wanted something that was outside the home.
I got the feeling that Constance and her mom didn't have the greatest relationship. And
yeah.
Do you think that was after the whole Floret thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just didn't get the warm motherly feelings coming from their memories of her.
Yeah, I didn't get that either.
Yeah.
And I think their mom also wanted to keep them tethered to the home as well, which is why she got rid of a lot of that correspondence course paperwork.
Exactly.
And that way, I forgot the details of that particular bit, but I think Constance was like just this close to getting, I think it was,
I have to go back
and
read
legal, that. Was it a legal thing?
I have to go back and check.
I'm doing real good with my deep dive information, aren't I?
No, but yeah, you're right. She did want to go, but the mother kept them all tethered there.
Yeah. So people, even back in the day, in more conservative times, they didn't necessarily have beliefs that conform to the norm.
Correct. And if I'm remembering correctly again, I think Francis, when the mother was still alive, didn't Francis ask for them to go and live with him? Or was it after the mother died?
I think it was after the mother died.
I think it was after
she died. Because they didn't like the idea of these three girls out on their own.
Right. And I love the fact that they kept it from Francis, all this stuff that's going on with Henry Kaufman.
Because he would have like swooped in and been like, you're moving back to the farm or my farm or whatever. We're going to sell this farm. You're going to move to my house.
Oh, and that's another thing. So this next book, I can't wait to see how Francis reacts to Constance becoming a deputy. And I do like his character. I'm hoping he doesn't turn out to be, you know,
dickhead.
Yeah. I was going to say a dick. We're on the same page.
Yeah. And then Florette's eavesdropping. Oh my God. She is hilarious.
Don't they have to like go to the pigeons or something to
talk?
They
have to go out in the middle of the field. Because if they go like where the pigeons are, she'll climb up, listen through the roof, the floorboards, the wall.
They have to go out into the field.
She would peer through keyholes, run outside and lean against door jams, or climb into the attic and press her ear against the gaps in the floorboards. Even the chicken coop was not safe as she would steal into the pigeon loft.
But think about this. They're out in the country by themselves. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have any friends. I mean, she has no friends. She doesn't go to school.
She needs excitement in her life.
Exactly. I would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I would do the same thing.
And doesn't out in the middle of the field, she ultimately runs up.
Yes.
On them. What are you keeping from me?
I do like Florette's character.
Oh, yeah. She's so extra. I love her.
Yep. Do we have anything else about this book? I mean, I would definitely recommend it.
Definitely. Read this book now. So if you're not sensitive to spoilers and you listen to us, I hope our deep dive made you want to read the book because it's a fun book.
It is a fun book. Amy Stewart does a really good job. Her characters are very real, and they are real, but they come to life.
Yeah, because you could write a novel like based on real people and they don't come to life because you don't know how to draw characters.
But I could see each one of her characters, even the deputies who you see for, I don't know, maybe a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. She has very good character development and descriptions and historical facts. So thank you, Carly. I never would have picked it up if I hadn't heard it on Procrastination Planet.
You're welcome, Janine. I'm glad I have added richness and color to your life.
Oh, yes. Always.
And your bookshelf. Okay, so that was our first deep dive into a whole entire novel.
We hope you liked it. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it, too. That was kind of fun.
Maybe we could do it again.
I'll have to find another book and annotate, etc. I'm kind of a slow reader.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm a slow reader, and plus I have all of my academic stuff on top of that.
Right.
So trying to fold that in a little bit here and there is kind of a challenge. But I'd like to be able to do more deep dives like this. If I can get around to researching and all that kind of thing, I want to do more like literary scandals and true crime and that kind of stuff too.
I loved your true crime episode that you did.
Oh, yeah. The one about Joe Orton.
Yes.
Tune into that one if you haven't already.
It's very interesting. Somebody I hadn't heard about, and the story was really interesting. And I would encourage you to do one like that again. That was really good. And I was just telling somebody the other day, I can't binge listen to murder podcasts, because if I text people or call people, especially my daughter who's 3,000 miles away, and they don't get back to me within 2 minutes, I think they're dead. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
I think we're done.
I think we're done. Okay. I'm Carly Knight.
I'm Janine Biggs.
And this has been Procrastination Planet.
Have a great week.
Now I got to check on the pups because they're demanding that I stop. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Procrastination Planet has been written and produced by me, Carly Knight. Our logo is designed by C. Trojan of C. Trojan Art. Our theme music is Laser Unicorns by Christian Penn, courtesy of Jamendo Licensing. Check us out at procrastinationplanet.com. Over there, you can catch links to our bonus content for every episode, as well as links to our Patreon and our Teespring pages.
All other sound at Procrastination Planet is courtesy of Charlie and Holly, our official podcast puppies. Don't forget to drop us an email at procrastinationplanetpod@gmail.com. Let us know how we're doing.